You're listening to All the Best. I'm Michaela Morgan. Today we're asking, how are you still alive? You'll hear stories of near misses, close shaves, and fortunate lives. People who are unlucky and then lucky. People who risk their lives just by being born. But first up, a story of people who risk their lives every so often just for fun. You might already know about base jumping. It's a sport where people jump from a fixed object, like skydiving, except without a plane. To properly call yourself a base jumper, you need to jump from a building, antenna, span, like a bridge, and earth, so a cliff.
First jump was like anything really. If you're into jumping off cliffs into the water and stuff when you're a kid, because that's what I used to do. It's very much similar to go base jumping. My name's Evan, I'm 24. Spent my childhood out at the airport packing parachutes, watching them come down and throwing parachutes off anything I could basically climb, really. First time I went base jumping was when I was 17. I was pretty young, very young for the sport, that's for sure. I did a thing in kindergarten and I drew all these aeroplanes and parachutes all over it. I used to build little parachutes, build model aeroplanes, grew up flying model aeroplanes and building kites, and I don't know, it's just something about flying, I suppose. I could never afford to be a pilot and always thought jumping out of a plane was heaps more fun than just flying one, so that's kind of what I pursued, I guess. I've done about 300 base jumps and nearly 800 skydives. I get nervous every single time. Sometimes you get kept up, at night, wake up with sweats, wake up thinking, oh no, is the alarm about to go off? Is it time? Is it time? Sometimes it feels like going to war. You're driving in the car, everyone's quiet. Walk in, everyone's just sort of focused. Same with skydiving. You can have a plane with 20 people and they're all yahooing on the ground. They get in the plane and everyone's just going through their jump in their head, visualising everything, thinking about all the risks, analysing everything. Everyone's quiet, serious. And then once the door opens, and then it's back to live action, everyone's yahooing again. Sometimes, when you're standing on the edge and you're about to jump, you accept the fact that it could be the last time, but it's just one of those things. I don't see it as such a dangerous sport that every time I go, it's like, oh no, this is going to be the end. Do you know what I mean? If I thought I was going to die every time, I wouldn't be doing it. Every jump's very, very calculated, and there's a lot of thought process goes into every single jump. It's not just a bunch of guys that are reckless that just turn up at a cliff and throw their bodies off. It's everything's analysed. You throw rocks if it's a cliff that you're opening or you're not too sure of. You can count how many seconds until it hits something. So always checking the winds. Everything is done and every risk is assessed and monitored and if anything, eliminated if you can to the best of your ability. If it all seems good to go and you've been there before, it's a pretty quick process. Gear up, have another look, say see you later and run off. And then like all those fears and all those things that you've thought about just go straight out the window when you jump off. Those first 4 seconds, that's when you get the real guts in your mouth feeling, people who know what that feels like. So those first 4 seconds is pretty scary, but pretty relaxing at the same time. And everything slows down very, very slow. 1 second feels like 10 seconds. They say it's like trying to explain sex to a virgin. But the closest thing to free fall would have to be lying in the water when you're just sort of zero gravity. That's kind of what free fall feels like, but the visual experience is just much more exhilarating. And then, landing the parachute's the next challenge. So once you've landed and all your buddies are sweet, it's all good. Go and walk out, get to the car, crack a cold beer. So celebrate. Always sat down with Mum and said that I'm going on a base trip. Could be the last time, but, love ya. That's for sure. Definitely have those conversations. because you just never know. Anything could happen. She's pretty good with it now. She gives me a hug to be safe. So she's accepted it. It's who I am, I guess. So, yeah, just make sure you give your mum a good hug. It's pretty tiring. So a lot of hard work. Everyone sees the videos and thinks, oh, that's cool. Look at YouTube and go, oh, I want to do that. But the reality of it is it's a hell of a lot of hard work for, you know, just a few seconds of relaxation and absolute adrenaline at the same time.
While base jumpers continually place themselves into danger in search of that adrenaline high, most near-death experiences tend to be a one-off, a freak situation that makes the survivor acutely aware of their own mortality. Our next story involves two car crashes and two sisters. This is Illa.
It has to start with my sister. It was Christmas Day and she came home, and basically in front of our house, she slid into another car. Slow pace, maybe 10 k's per hour. But the car was damaged enough to cause a $12,000 damage. Christmas Day in northern Germany, where we grew up, in a small village. It gets really icy on the streets in winter, and it takes some skill to drive cars. So she came back home and told my parents, and they really gave her a hard time because we have a pub, and around Christmas, my mum's a chef. My dad had to take care of all the orders and preparations for many, many, many guests who arrive for the Christmas period. They weren't happy. They really gave her a hard time. They repaired the car, paid the fine, couldn't believe how expensive it was, and that Christmas was just, they thought it was ruined, and they gave my sister a hard time for it. The car that my sister drove was my dad's car, and we all used it. Black limousine, very big car, like the kind of car that a successful businessman would drive. 3 months later, I was taking the very same car to pick up my sister from the train station. It was just 16 kilometers away, country roads, and I knew them like the pocket of my jeans. It's just one of those drives that you do all the time. And there were two zones that were limit restricted to 70, and I came out of one of them and I sped up well beyond 120 k's per hour, and I knew I could take that corner at 140, but then I decided that the music was rubbish and I looked towards the radio and I turned my music on. And that's when I got off the road onto the grass and I jolted, and that jolt made me tear the steering wheel around to the left. So I swerved across the street, but I swerved much too far, and I swerved back to stay on the street. But then I was out of control already, and the car was more sliding than on its tires. And I saw this tree coming at me, and the only thing I could think was like, don't hit the tree, don't hit the tree, don't hit the tree, don't damage the car. As long as you just slide, it's all good. And then I flipped twice and I landed on the tires again, and I thought, yep, you hit the tree. Okay. I looked at the radio and it sparked a bit. The music was out and I saw the street map book in front of me. It was lying in the back and it had flown past my head and hit my ear a little bit, but that was the only thing that hurt. And I was very tense, so I let go of the steering wheel, but it dropped into my lap, and I was like, what? I have ripped the steering wheel out. That's crazy. So I opened the door, got out of the car, and I was in this very calm state. Although I could open the doors and the boot and everything, the front of the car had burrowed into a creek, and it was 1.5, 2 meters into the ground on the one corner, and the other corner was wide open. And I looked into it, and I was like, that's where the engine should be. But it was all ripped apart. I looked around, had a good look at the car, and kept on collecting the things from the street and put all of them in the boot, one by one. They told me that I had picked up probably, I don't know how heavy an engine is, but definitely too heavy for me to carry. And I'd picked up this engine and put it back in the boot. And then I sat down under the tree because I didn't know anything else to do. I just knew, like, I have to wait for someone to turn up. It was before mobile phone time. Someone came by and asked me if I was all right and looked really worried and said, like, oh, you're Hermann's daughter. I know Hermann. I can call Hermann. He's coming. Don't worry, don't worry. This is all going to be fine. And I was like, yeah. When my dad arrived and he hugged me, and it was the best hug in my life. It was just like this deep feeling of safety. And I think that's when I came out of the shock a little bit. And I looked at the car and I started crying. And I thought, like, fuck, this is really bad accident. I don't know how long we were standing there, but I think for a very long time. Although I still love speed, I've definitely become a lot more responsible and also careful about my body. And you remember those states of shock that give you such a different experience of what life normally feels like. And you're very aware of your own mortality. Yeah, so from there, we brought the car back home. My dad took me home in his car, his other car. And we have a pub, so the damaged car was standing in front of the pub on the yard, and we walked in, my mum was there, and opened a bottle of champagne. There were a few guests, and then everyone just toasted. And was really cheerful and happy that I hadn't died and that it was all good, because it was such a big shock. And we were waiting for my sister. We knew already that she'd been picked up by someone else now. And when she came into the bar, my dad had just said, like, oh, fantastic, since Christmas I wanted to sell this car, but no one wanted to give me a good price, and now the insurance is not going to take care of that. And my sister's face just froze. She got so angry. And poor thing, she's like the older one, is always the one that gets it harder. She was just storming out saying that it was just so unfair.
That story was produced for us by Zasha Rosen, with sound design by Bryce Halliday.
How are you still alive? How are you still alive? How are you breathing when you should be bleeding? How are you still alive? How are you walking around?
All the Best producer Tiger Webb was born too early. 15 weeks too early. He tells us it was kind of a huge deal in late 80s Brisbane.
So this is actually a pretty terrible story in narrative terms. There's no suspense. I obviously survived. I'm here. I'm telling it to you. But, you know, as I guess they say, it was such a formative experience. I was born 15 weeks early, and it was kind of a huge deal in Brisbane in the late 80s. I weighed 820 grams. I didn't even look human. There are photos of me taken from around about the time, and I look like one of H.R. Giger's aliens, you know, all teeth and stretched skin. The chances of babies born around that time surviving aren't great now. They definitely weren't great then. My parents reckoned I had to fight for my life like a tiger, and hence my name. And that's it. That's the happy ending. Only I had a twin. We didn't come from the same mother. He was someone else's kid, a friend of my dad's. I think they'd become like pregnancy friends, the kind of companions you only really get through surviving traumatic experiences. And despite being unborn and not actually possessing a personality, us twins, as our parents jokingly referred to us, had a lot in common. Our mothers even went into labor around about the same time as one another. But then we started picking up divergent interests. I was delivered by C-section. He wasn't. I lived, he died. My name's Tiger. His name was Leo. Leo's parents stayed in touch with ours over the years. They used to come round to Christmas parties at our place. And with Christmas parties, well, you've got to understand, I'm from a big family. You know, I'm the youngest, but there's always, you know, nieces and nephews, cousins around. So this couple who had lost a child would come to our Christmas parties. I mean, you can see where this is going, right? Christmas parties with homemade bonbons and children, happy, healthy, live children frolicking around them who'd survived when theirs hadn't. Of course it was too much for them. You know, I've got red hair. I was a loud kid. I loved singing and dancing. And you bet his parents would have looked at me and thought, how are you still alive when Leo isn't? You know, after a while, Leo's parents stopped coming around for Christmas. History gets easy when you start looking at it like it's a pair of branching binary decisions. Caesarean, vaginal birth. Child, no child. Events are hardly that neat when they're happening. But even then, the doctor that delivered me would later go on to write the textbook on handling premature births. How do you control for a variable like that? I was moved after a few days to a different hospital. And in what seems to me like a serious breach of procedural ethics, a nurse told my dad about another kid who had been born as early as me to different doctors and different parents. She died too. You know, I was even part of a pilot study growing up, examining the effects of oxygen on premature births. We had yearly checkups. After year 5, my parents were told to stop bringing me. I was too healthy, not showing the signs of physical or intellectual difficulties that premature kids often get. I was skewing up the study numbers. God, I hope that conversation was held in private. What a slap in the face for the other parents. And my folks told me all this once when I was very young. I think it's understandable. For them, this story is a celebration. I'm their miracle child, the one who tore through all these mathematical impossibilities to be here. They never had another kid, and I guess you wouldn't, would you? But they told me about Leo, and about my doctor, and how lucky I was to be alive. And I think their joke about Leo and I being twins really stuck with me then. You know, I didn't see the miracle of my circumstances. I just felt haunted. You know, I felt a slight and ghostly hand holding mine. Why am I here? I didn't earn this. That's another truth then. Nobody earns it. Maybe that's why we get so appalled at the death of children, in hospitals or in war. We look at that empty, scarred space where a child was and think, we never got a chance to see if they earned the right to be here. My birthday is coming up soon. I'll be 25. Quarter centuries are kind of like the new 21st, you know? I'll be expected to have a party. Friends, family, there'll be a cake, of course. My mum loves baking. Leo's parents won't be there. We stopped expecting them a long time ago.
That was Tiger Webb, one of our supervising producers here at All the Best. Tom Carew-Reed is constantly telling stories that end in his friends asking, "How are you still alive?" Some of them are obviously exaggerated, some of them are probably true to the word, but all of them are full of near misses and heightened drama. His friend, our features executive producer Jess O'Callaghan, asked him about one of his favourite stories, about the time he jumped on a lilo and wandered through the New Zealand countryside.
So I was 13 at the time. Here I was, little chubby redhead, you know, easily sunburnable, wearing his two-piece bather suit with the skivvy riding up at the back. No shoes, no hat, no sunscreen. It starts in New Zealand. We were there for my stepfather's family Christmas. It was my first time overseas, actually, so it was really exciting. So I think it was the day before New Year's, and my stepfather at the time decided to take us on this adventure. We went to go do this thing called liloing. So in New Zealand, like, it's a pastime for young kids to blow up mattresses and then set off down a river. and just cruise along, you know, and look at everything that's beautiful and whatever. So that's what we did. And as we were driving up in the car, you know, my mum decided that she wasn't keen on doing it because she doesn't like wearing bathers for some reason. So she was staying at the pub where the river was finishing, waiting for us to come through. So she dropped us off, me and my three younger brothers and my stepfather. And so we got off, you know, cruising down the river for about 10 minutes, and we were going through this beautiful gorge with like thyme bushes growing all the way up the top. It smelt beautiful and the sun was out. And then we hit some rapids, which I thought was really exciting. We all went on. My brothers were a bit scared, but I was like, come on, let's keep going. And my stepfather, being from New Zealand, had plenty of times doing this, so he was in control. So we kept going down, and it started to get more and more crazy, like more white water, more rocks. But being the adventurous type, I was, that excited me still. And my two of my younger brothers started to get they suffer from asthma, so they were starting to hyperventilate. So my stepdad decided that it would be prudent for him to take them out of the water and go back. And I decided to keep going because I was probably trying to make a point. So he said to me, you know, it's going to be only like maybe 300, 400 meters further down. So I kept going on by myself, you know, and half an hour later, I was forced to peel off to the side of the river, which was in the middle of this massive gorge at this time. So it was about 100 meters tall above me on either side, and I couldn't see any direction but forward. And so I got off and proceeded to climb up the cliff by holding onto these thyme bushes that were growing everywhere. I made my way all up to the top, and by this time I had peeled, you know, two layers of skin off my fingers from trying to climb up. And when I got to the top and I looked around searching for a road, and all I could see was just an expansive fields of nothing for everywhere I could see. I couldn't see anything. So I decided just to start walking to hopefully find a road. So I kept walking. I was walking for about half an hour, and when I found this 3-meter-high fence, which I thought was really strange because I was like, oh, no, what sort of sheep are they like? So I kept walking, and I reached this little gully with like a small pond in it. And I was standing there, like, not knowing what to do at this point. And I was more worried about how my mum was feeling, because at this stage I'd been gone for 4 hours. It's 4 hours by myself in New Zealand wilderness. And I heard this, like pattering. And I was like, what the hell is that? And from over the hill behind me came this, like, stampede of deer charging over, and I freaked out. And I started running, and I ran for about 10 minutes, heart pounding, and I reached another fence. And this fence was probably even higher, or it felt even higher at this stage because I've been walking for about 4 hours by myself. So I climbed this fence, and I kept walking, and I kept walking, and had no idea what I was doing. I hadn't drunk anything for, this is now pushing 6 hours. Finally, I don't know after how long, I found this tiny little dirt track, and I followed this track, and I finally reached this road, and I was like, oh my god, thank god, I've like found some civilization. Stood at the side of this road waiting for some sort of traffic to go past, and we were in the middle of farmland as well, so there wasn't much traffic going through. But finally I decided that I just had to keep walking. So walking, and I saw right off in the distance on the top of this hill this little farmhouse, and I was like, oh my god, so thirsty at this point. So thirsty, like dry. Oh, I also had no shoes. Bitumen road, gravel, rocks, deer poo. So I approached this house and I went inside, and I was looking around for people, knocking on doors, and there was no one there. And then I saw this car driving up to the house, and then I ran out into the road, like pretty hysterical, I think, at this point. And they just had no idea what this kid was doing in his bathers and no shoes, like bright red from being sunburned. And they offered me some water, and then I had to sit down for a moment to try and explain what actually happened to me. The only thing I knew was that my mum was waiting for me at this pub. I got in this car and they took me around, and the first pub that we went to wasn't the pub that my mum was at. Apparently New Zealand has lots of pubs everywhere. So we were driving around for a while, and finally I was like, no, I'd explained to them that it was one next to a river, you know, where the gorge comes out. And they said, you know, no, that river that you got on, doesn't open up until pretty much the bottom of the South Island. So I was stuffed. If I hadn't got out then, I don't know what would have happened. But they took me and finally I found this pub where I thought my mum was, and I rushed out and looked around and I couldn't see the car. And now the sun was starting to set, it was about 9 o'clock. My only option really was just to go inside and ask and see if people knew where my family was. The local publican was just like, oh God, finally. Apparently my mum had left messages, but I had no idea about how to contact anyone. And the only number that I could remember was my grandparents' number in Perth, Western Australia. I had to go out the back and make an international call to Perth to tell my grandma, who is the biggest worrywart in the world, that I was lost. Then she proceeded to call my stepdad in New Zealand, and they finally found me, and it's pushing about 10:30 now. So we left at 2, so I don't know, that's 8 hours, 8.5 hours. 20 minutes later, the car comes screaming into the car park, and my mum jumps out of the car. You know, I thought she'd be really happy, but she looked so angry. They took me home to where we were staying, and so the story was on their side that my mum had been waiting there for 3 hours, then asked someone and found out that we'd gone down the wrong river. And she was absolutely mortified. When my stepdad and my three brothers returned to the pub to tell them that I was coming out the other end, my mum went into a bit of a panic. My cousin, who's a pilot, had his little plane, like one of those little flying planes, at the house that we were staying at. So they were just about ready to send up a plane to come looking for me. And then they got the phone call and I was found. And to this day, you know, we're still not allowed to talk about it with my stepdad. It's like a no-go story, but I like to tell it sometimes just to have a poke because I think it's funny.
That was Tom Carew-Reed talking to one of our features executive producers, Jess O'Callaghan. This episode of All the Best was produced at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with Sin Radio in Melbourne and 4ZZZ in Brisbane. Thanks to all of the producers who contributed to this episode, Heidi Pett, Zasha Rosen, Bryce Halliday, Tiger Webb and Jess O'Callaghan. Our features executive producers are Heidi Pett and Jess O'Callaghan. Our community coordinator is Pitt Rasmussen. Our executive producer is Jordana Caputo. And I'm Michaela Morgan. All the Best is played across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation.